Gravitas Impact offers a global community of the world's top business coaches. We strive to empower our coaches and clients alike to achieve their extraordinary goals.
Hello, everyone. This is Keith Cupp, CEO of Gravitas Impact Premium Coaches. And on today's podcast, we have Greg Crabtree. Greg's a speaker, author, entrepreneur, and financial expert. He's the CEO of Crabtree Roe and Berger in Alabama, and they dedicate themselves to helping entrepreneurs build the economic engine of their business. Greg is also the author of Simple Numbers, Straight Talk, Big Profits 1.0, which we'll get to in a little bit, where he talks about sharing the core principles on how to turn your business into a wealth engine for your life. Greg, welcome to the podcast today.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Oh, great to have you. And we'll probably go pretty deep here today and make this a part one and part two. Let's start with this, Greg. In preparing, you had kind of a theme or provocative statement. Why don't you share that with the audience now, and then we'll come back and develop that.
Well, you know, to me, the one thing I provoke entrepreneurs based on my research over the last few years is really having them understand, you know, ask them the question, what do you think the appropriate return on invested capital is of the business that you have? And when I say invested capital, what is the stuff that required you? You may have built it up through retention of profit. You may have put some cash in. You may have had an outside investor. All of those things count as invested capital. So what is it that it takes to fund your receivables, your inventory, if you have any, minus whatever you get in trade support, minus the cash that you need to have on hand, minus the fixed assets that you need to have? The sum of all that input for most privately held businesses is close to the equity number. It's not precisely equity, but it's pretty close. It says, what kind of return should you get on that? So can you think of your business as an investment? And then I always ask them the question, and I get some usually the average answer is 15, 20%, maybe 30%. I said, would it shock you if my recommendation is the minimum number? The minimum number should be is 50%. And oh, by the way, the average based on our research of privately held businesses is closer to 75 to 90 to 100%. In some cases, well above 100%, depending on the business model. And I say that way, the biggest challenge that I see with entrepreneurs is they don't have an understanding of the investment value of the business as it sits in their hands. And so we'll talk about this in a little bit in terms of kind of what is your business value play that you're running in your game plan, you know, but essentially until you understand your business as an investment, you're really just living moment to moment, day to day with not a greater long-term strategy. And plus, when you understand that you have an investment, and I always kind of present it this way, if you have 100% CD and you put $100,000 in it, a year later, you got $100,000 of interest. You got $100,000 of principal. You could take that $200,000. Oh, by the way, the IRS needs about 40% of that interest for taxes because it is taxable income. So you got $160,000 that you could reinvest. Wouldn't you think you would do it again? Or would you take that money out and go buy a vacation home or buy a new car or just consume it randomly in the course of, oh, I'm a business owner and I get to have the perks of being in a business? If you start thinking about your business as an investment of saying, why would I ever think about pulling money out of the business if there is more things it can do at that same rate of return if I keep reinvesting in it? Mm-hmm. And that's huge.
So I'm hearing two things then. So one is the minimum really kind of target or higher acceptable level of return on invested capital is 50%. So let's have that in our audience. And Greg, in a moment, I'm going to have you come back and define that one more time to be clear. Sure. The other thing I'm hearing too is, hey, CEOs, don't get caught in the trap of thinking and acting like a consumer versus an investor.
Right.
And that's huge because many of the businesses that we are building are legacy businesses for our families and for other things in life. So Greg, before we go deep, tell us a little bit about yourself. What gives you the authority to talk about this? Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about you know, what you do day to day and a little bit about your background and your research.
Well, you know, I mean, for me, it, you know, I've been in practice with partners since 1986. And so originally we were traditional local accountants. And, you know, and that actually isn't very exciting. So I'd always enjoy a few consulting projects along. And then fast forward 2001, I became aware of this group called the Entrepreneurs Organization, joined. And really joining EO kind of turned my eye towards what my need was, because it, like many of the listeners, you're part of business groups or forums, various organizations, whether it's EO or other YPO, all of them use these similar small group. And my other forum mates, I was able to use them as my focus group, because by forum rules, I wasn't allowed to do business with them. And so they were nine people of the perfect profile of who I wanted to do business with, but I couldn't. And essentially, they showed me what my profession sucked at. And it really was the fact that, oh, by the way, hey, you know, they told me three things. We don't want the tax day surprise of unexpected cash outflow, which I said, okay, I can fix that. They wanted billing by the fixed price, so there's no surprises. So I said, okay, well, we now do almost all of our work is fixed price. But the third piece was, oh, by the way, you see hundreds of people's most intimate details. You got to have some idea of what works and what doesn't. And here in our mind as a firm, we have access to this information, but we weren't doing the highest best thing with it. We were doing the lowest value thing with it, which was doing audits and financial statements, tax returns and those things, when realistically, I had a group of information here that I could basically study and prepare from. And so the first book, I did some limited studies that developed observational things that I put in the first simple numbers book. Since then, we've developed more sophisticated tracking models of looking at how this data has moved across time. Plus, one of the advantages in EO that I got is I get to chair an executive ed program each year at Wharton Business School. And the lead professor there, I have to give David Wessels all the credit in the world. He was the one that really turned me on to this concept of return on invested capital, which is a metric that's been around forever. It's a metric that you see in publicly held financial statements all the time. But nobody's ever really looked at that number for the private sector and done significant research on it that I'm aware of. I mean, if they have, it didn't rise to the level of people knowing about it. And so as I started studying it, I was really blown away, because of anybody who I considered, you know, achieving an achievable level of minimum acceptable profitability, you know, everybody was 50% or higher as long as it was in a developed economy. Now, I will tell you this, we've done some work with people in emerging economies, and it's hard to get to that 50% number for a couple of reasons, just because of lack of trust in the trade system in terms of them having to carry receivables an inordinate length of time or having to pay vendors upon immediate access of goods because there's no trust. But in a trust-based developed economy, we've not seen a single business that couldn't meet the 50% or higher standard. And then in addition to that, we've got a 50-company model that we continue to monitor for economic performance for U.S. companies. And the average return on investment of those companies is actually 75 to 100%, depending on any given year. And that's about a $300 million-plus revenue of, you know, if you look at it as a conglomerate, it's about a $300-plus million model. That we monitor on an ongoing basis that gives us some statistical data, because our clients are spread all over the world. So we're not geographically limited as to where we do business. And so we can get a pretty nice sampling across a bunch of industries, because we don't focus on one industry either. And so it was really was just a mind-blowing thing, because in my original book, I hypothesized, as you remember, 5% was on life support and profit, 10% was a good profit, 15% was great. And that worked for about 70% of the businesses, but I couldn't tell you why. I had correlated data. I didn't have causated data. And so as I looked at this next study that we did here a couple of years ago and started tracking it, I really believe that the cause of appropriate profitability is an expectation of a return on investment that's 50% or higher. And so if you can't get to that in your business model, I'm going to tell you that you're going to be really struggling to have long-term viability.
Okay, good, good. And so I want, for the audience, I want to just also a little bit more on Greg. So he's served on the global board of the Entrepreneurs Organization and also is a participant in the U.S. State Department's New Beginnings Program for International Entrepreneurs. So although the model is most indicative of a developed, trust-based, developed economy, Greg has tremendous insights worldwide. Greg, let's go back to your provocative statement. And why don't you develop that a little bit more? Talk about your research really has been over 30 years. Most recently, in the last several years, you've been focusing on it. Let's go ahead and go a little bit deeper on this 50% or higher return on invested capital.
Right. And so first, let's talk about capital. And so the one of the biggest challenges, and you know this from coaching businesses, is that most people can talk P&L on a decent level of knowledge, but they don't understand the balance sheet. And for practical reasons, balance sheets are built for accountants to balance things and keep things, it's a control document. But it also in it is telling you the capital formation. We just do a horrible job of structuring it in a way that's readable. And so in the new book, Simple Numbers 2.0, we talk about essentially just rip up the balance sheet and let's don't think about assets on the left and liabilities and capital on the right. Let's look at functional groupings of data that builds a capital structure. So essentially in an ongoing business, there's three capital components that every business needs to have. The first one being trade capital. So think of trade capital is really simply working capital, current assets minus current liabilities, excluding cash and debt. So forget about cash, forget about debt, short-term debt. Just look at inventory, work in progress, other current assets, minus accounts payable, and accrued expenses, and deferred revenue. And if I net those two numbers together, that's actually a more important number because that is what the market is forcing onto me. Now, I can use some techniques. My good friend Alan Miltz, that you guys have probably, you know, many people have heard Alan's material. Alan does a great job of talking about, you know, the stories of cash flow. Well, this kind of gets into, you know, a lot of things that, you know, listening to Alan give his presentation really has kind of spurred me to think through this in a different way. And essentially this idea of trade capital is these are the market forces of receivables and payment terms that we many times talk about in the cash conversion cycle and those things. And so what we were able to do is if you look at that number as a net number, so that's the first component that everybody needs to be able to fund in a business. Some people don't have receivables. Some people don't have deferred revenue. Some people have payables. Others don't. Some people have inventory. It doesn't really matter. It's the net of all of those things that matters. The second building block of capital is infrastructure capital. So essentially, what are my fixed assets, building, equipment, whatever, minus accumulated depreciation, minus the debt associated with it. If I buy a delivery vehicle for $50,000 and I 100% finance it, do I have any infrastructure capital? No. What I've essentially done is take, because I've been able to finance it, I really don't have any capital requirements because that payment, if you follow it through the accounting system hoodoo of things, essentially depreciation and principal and interest works out to be essentially the same number effectively across the life of that note. And so we would actually make accounting pretty simple if we actually just expense the payment. You know, but that's a whole nother topic. Now, but essentially, you know, but sometimes if you go buy a building, well, they're not doing 100% financing a building. So you got to put 20% or more down, and then the rest turns into a supportive number that then gets funded through rent or those kind of things. And so essentially, what is that piece that I had to put into it? That's the capital component. And then the third piece is my favorite. In the capital structure, I call it buffer capital, but it's what you guys who have listened to my stuff before, I call the core capital target, the 2 months of operating expenses in cash. Now, here's what I will tell you though. When I want a 50% return or better, if you're not carrying the 2 months of buffer capital that you need to have, I'm going to put it in the calculation. I'm not going to give you credit for leveraging. I may show you what it is leveraged, but I'm not going to let you get away with it. You know, your 50% hard requirement is with 2 months of operating cash, whether you have it or not in that regard. And so what's really fascinating with this is, so if you look at that, if you look at your, like, for example, your trade capital, because your trade capital floats, it's a variable capital component. As I get bigger, I will have more trade capital required. I may not have much in the way of infrastructure, depending on what kind of business I have, unless I'm a facilities heavy equipment or facilities heavy business model. The cash number will grow with scaling as well. And so essentially what I can do is, when I look at trade capital as a percentage of revenue, it gives me what we call a trade capital signature. So if, let's say, for example, if my trade capital divided by annual run rate of revenue is, say, 12%, and my profit is at 8%, I can't scale infinitely. I'm going to burn cash to grow by 4%. If my profit is 15% and my trade capital is 12, I'm in what I call the cash flow free growth zone. I can grow as fast as I want, and I'll be able to fund it out of my own cash.
Hey, Greg, let me highlight that. What I just heard you say, if your profit is greater than mm-hmm. your trade capital signature,
right,
then you have an engine for self-funding, which is amazing.
It actually is. And then if I'm below it, if it's a close, but I'm slightly below, you're what we refer to as a base camp growth model. And so essentially, you have to grow until you run out of fundable resources, debt and cash, until you hit you draw a line in the sand of saying, hey, we can't grow past this point or else we're going to go red, and we got to be, can't be that that dangerous in terms of how we run our business. And so you pause growth, let the cash catch up. And so I was just looking at a model before this call, and a client who has a 33% trade capital signature, which is not good, but the industry that they're in is one that does require longer terms. So he typically has about 120 days of cost in what he's got to fund. And so what's interesting is they had a growth spurt about 120 days ago and then stabilized and then have kind of been running, you know, pretty consistent from there. And what's interesting is their trade capital shot up right at that growth spurt. And then by pausing, now they're back down to their more true operating number 120 days later. Amazing. Well, you know, that's math. I mean, that's the way it works. And so as you understand these things, you know, so a company that does not have the cash flow free signature, then you got to grow in seasons. You grow and then pull back and pause and let the cash catch up. There's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, and otherwise, you've got to seek the secondary sources of the marketplace and say, you know, I got to go get outside capital. And what is the cost of that capital? Now, here's the thing, though. I've just given you an interesting number to understand. If I'm making a 50 to 75% return on my invested capital and I go attract more patient outside capital that I know I can grow with, and I only agree to give them a preferred rate of, say, 15%, well, guess what? If I'm really good at executing, I can afford that outside capital. But see, I got to think in those terms, and I've got to know that I can actually go take that capital and deploy it. Now, what I see in the people that go get outside capital is they get the money and it's really just to take the debt pressure off of them, but they don't understand how to set the new target that they've got to aim for because they've gotten this influx of capital. Mm-hmm. And Greg, if you can't go execute on that, don't go get the capital.
Greg, let's talk about, do you have a specific industry or example? Let's go a little bit deeper to illustrate this. Okay. You referred to one a moment ago, but let's make this real in the minds of our CEOs listening in with that.
Sure. So in terms, we did this presentation for a group of managed service providers. So we work with another group that has, we got 15 of these guys in a mastermind group that we do for their industry. And so I showed them an example, two of our clients in the exact same industry. And so one of them is doing about $3 million of revenue, making 20% profit. Their trade capital signature is minus 2%. So what that means is for every $100,000 of revenue that they do, that they have $2,000 of their customers' money before they incur any cost. Let's fast forward. Another one we have that's doing about $5 million in revenue, exact same industry. They have a 10% trade capital signature, which means for every $100,000, they have to put $10,000 of their own money in it. Mm-hmm. Now, if they both operate at 15% profitability, the one that has 2% trade capital and has the appropriate 2 months of operating expenses in cash, they have a 286% return on invested capital. The other one at best is going to get to 85%, which is not bad. Now, they're presently not at 85% because of the challenges, they're actually operating at break even. They actually have gotten sloppy. At one time, they were at 15% profit, you know, but they've fallen off of that. And then they have two things that are putting pressure on them. They have a poor cash flow engine of their terms that the marketplace clearly accepts those terms to pay in advance that they've not enacted on. And then two, they don't have the relative profitability relative to that cash flow. So it's killing them in two ways that are not obvious to the typical financial reader. They're not getting a return on investment of just their current profitability, but they're also investing too much cash when the market clearly allows them to use less cash, given the current acceptance of payment terms in that industry. And so they're not prepared to scale. They're not prepared to grow. Whereas the other one that has 2% trade capital, the only capital that the other one has is essentially their 2 months of operating expenses in cash. That's the only capital requirement that they have. And I will tell you, that is the most dominant business trend that I see of all the businesses that we break down, is moving towards more and more of these privately held businesses that have a much skinnier capital requirement to launch. Now, that also opens up the fact that if people have access to capital, you know, if somebody is good at marshaling that capital and solving a need, doesn't mean that you can't do it in other industries that do require that capital. But, you know, but there's a lot of money to be made, a lot of business to be grown that really you don't have to put a lot of capital in it. You just have to be good at executing, which is really what all of you guys listening to this podcast is what you're tasked with. I mean, that's why we're huge fans of business coaches for our clients, because you guys are essential to keeping businesses on track and keeping pace with consistent execution to make that return on invested capital happen.
And so, Greg, I'm going to summarize briefly, and then we're going to bookmark here for part one of this podcast. And so we started off by saying, hey, if you are in a developed trust-based economy, you should be focusing as an owner of the organization on a return on invested capital of 50% or higher. And Correct. Then you talked about the three capital sources,
right?
With trade capital being the one that you can focus on to really help tune the company in order to get your trade capital signature, your ratio optimized. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that is absolutely accurate.
Okay.
Now I will plant the seed. We may discuss this in part two, but there actually is a fourth capital component, but it does not reside on your balance sheet. And it is what we call launch capital. So this is capital expenditures that through a weakness in accounting hides in your P&L, that these are discretionary expenses that we all spend money on, but we don't know how to hold them accountable for proper growth and profitability enhancement. And so that I call launch capital the magic pixie dust of business. So.
All right. This is a great place to bookmark. So listeners, we're with Greg Crabtree today. Speaker, author, and entrepreneur, financial expert, author of Simple Numbers, Straight Talk, Big Profits. Greg has a second book coming out, which we'll talk about in part two of the podcast. And My name is Keith Kupp. I'm the CEO of Gravitas Impact. We're a worldwide community of trusted advisors serving middle market CEOs and their leadership teams with growth tools, experience, and guidance. If you'd like any help, just reach out to gravitasimpact.com or give me an email at Keith, K-E-I-T-H, at gravitasimpact.com.
For more valuable content and actionable resources, visit www.gravitasimpact.com.